So hopefully today I'm going to be talking specifically about the project that I've been on and who I work for, and specifically method that we use, and I hope, and a little background too, so I hope you can take away at least one good thing with you today. If you have questions, I feel like we have a huge bank of intelligence and experience in here, so please feel free to jump in at any point. So just a little bit to get started. I'm on a project right now that's looking at coastal climate change and is working with coastal communities in 7 different states, just a case study to look at kind of how their policymakers in the communities are using climate change science, whether they're willing to use climate change science in their long and short-term planning, and just using climate science as a lens in their policy planning, just whether or not they're thinking about it. And then, of course, what are some of the barriers to them using the science? Do they have a political issue with it? Is it going to affect their business if there's different regulations put on them because of some sort of change that's going to happen in policy? So kind of hard to put your finger on. It's hard. We talk about downscaling the climate science to a local level, which is hard to do. So we're taking the science as talking about greater uncertainty in the future, and we're talking to these policymakers saying, okay, how, you know, can you use this as something that you're interested in learning more about? How can we help you? And my organization tries to keep a very neutral stance. I know the other night somebody asked me about being timid as an organization, but our goal really isn't to go in and say, here's what you need to do. These are the best practices that you need to put in place. We actually want to go in and be supportive and give the people who we're working with what they need, what they want, and what kind of match up with. So that's kind of where I'm coming from with this. But the method that we use comes from this risk decision background. Is anybody familiar with risk decision? So there are a lot of different fields that research this idea of risk, and we're talking specifically environmental risk. So if you think about it now, a lot of the risks to us as humans are kind of invisible. If you think just even about Holden, and some of the risks of climate change or fire, or even like the mine tailings, or in your own community there might be chemicals in the soil that you're not, you know, there's a lot of risks that you're not completely aware of or perceive, or everybody in the community doesn't necessarily perceive. And so the method that we use comes from a group out of Carnegie Mellon who work with risk perception and decision making based on the risks facing the communities. So, we see climate change as a risk to the community, and so I'm using this specific method for that. How about risks in your community? It's just for me to think about this. What do you think the number one risk in your home community would be to say community health or people? Or are there things that your community is thinking of that would be a risk?
We have radiation from Hanford Nuclear Reservation.
Okay. They're down with their
concern. Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I see homelessness as the greatest risk to overall community health.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I guess I would say, at least in our community, to take on not only homelessness, but like, you know, drug and alcohol abuse and poverty and just all of those.
Yes, poverty might be a strong rubric.
So, I'm usually thinking about environmental issues and things in the environment that might cause it, like cancer.
That's the environment.
So maybe,
the environment I work in, there's homeless people there.
Are they the receptors of risk, or are they themselves the hazard, is what I'm asking. Like, are they the ones who are experiencing risk, or what is that?
Or are they causing?
It's a risk to everyone. And they're the canary in the coal mine. Okay, adequate health care, adequate access to health care is another.
Yeah, and those are probably indicators the actual danger.
Okay.
I mean, I don't think that homeless people threaten us directly.
Okay.
But first, they're part of the community. And as being homeless is a terrible risk to their health.
Right, okay, yeah, all right. So. When I do, I just use a very simple model. Is that big enough for you guys to see?
No, well, yes.
Okay, that's the word receptor. So when the basically with this method that we use, we go into a community and we're thinking about one particular topic. In my case, it was climate change. And we work with just a few scientists, and we create this model of vulnerability. And has anybody ever heard of a vulnerability assessment before? Yeah, okay. So we do something, a simplified vulnerability assessment. We don't go into huge amounts of science, because if you think about it, there's only so much that you really need to know to be able to make a good decision for your community. Like, you don't need to go into all the ocean chemistry to be able to say things are changing in the ocean. You need to think about it. So one model that I just simplified one, we look at the hazard or the risk. I'll try to make this bigger. And then, and then we also look at the receptors. So, for instance, the hazard might be erosion. And then the receptors might be, world erosion, the people, the community. And receptors are usually the things that are actually experiencing the hazard. And so we go through, and we talk about that, the pathways and the drivers. So the pathways would be, pathways and drivers. And it's really not that important to understand this whole system, but we kind of create an expert model and work with the scientists. And in here at Pullman, I actually downloaded the U.S. Forest Service last June, created a conceptual model of the risks associated with mine tailings and cleaning up the mine tailings. And so they actually have this diagram of the side of the hill, you know, where the water's coming out, where that's going, and what it's affecting. And that is the kind of model that we would use if we went into a community to talk about risk there, to do this, to start this process of non-persuasive communication. So that's kind of where we start. And then from there, like I was talking about earlier in the week, sometimes people don't want to hear about risk, or especially with a controversial topic like climate change. You know, there are so many other things framing the issue that we call barriers to communication. And so we really don't want to go in and say, here's what you need to do, we're the experts. This is, you know, it's top down, it's one way of communication coming from the experts to you as a community. We really want to find out, like, what's keeping people from using information that we have, and how can we better serve them. So it's non-persuasive, and that it's two-way, I guess,
Do you actually think about how you present the information to people, like using certain verbs or certain parts of speech in the way you actually present the information to them, as opposed to others, you know, passive verbs versus active verbs?
Yeah, and that's the thing, is that's a very specific, this is, I guess, non-persuasive communication in this case would be more of a community process, is what I'm talking about. And it's not necessarily the actual outreach materials that we hand them, it's the community process that we go through. So how many of you have ever participated in university study before? A university study where you were interviewed or surveyed or anything? So this method is called mixed methods, and so we want to go in and collect qualitative data. So we want to go in and talk to people, and that's where we really start. And the process for this is very intense, because we have to go through this institutional review board. We have to take our questions to this board at our university and ask, are we going to damage anybody by asking them these questions? And so we use this, for my particular study, it's called the risk communication method. I have really bad handwriting up here. And it's, so basically we go in and we start by asking some very broad questions. So I'm just going to start like I would in an interview. And I usually interview 20 to 30 people at the beginning of the project. And from there, we take a look at the interviews, and we look for things like misconceptions, background beliefs, stuff that people already know, and then kind of peripheral beliefs, or beliefs that don't really have anything to do with the issue, but that people are kind of stuck on. And from there, we do a survey of the greater community, and we find out, what is everybody else thinking? And then finally, we create communication material. So, to just kind of take you through the process, I would ask probably 15 questions, and it would be about a half hour to 45 minute interview to begin with. And I might ask, what topic do you guys want to do? Climate change?
Sure.
Okay. But I want to tell people, I would say, hi, I'm representing Oregon Sea Grant, and I'm here to just ask you some questions about this topic. You've been identified in the community as a leader whose opinion we want to hear. It'll be recorded. Only our research team will be looking at the results, and we're just interested in being able to create better communication materials for them as well. So I might start out with a very broad, open-ended question and just give people a chance to talk about their impressions. So we usually start out by asking, like, what's the climate like in this area? And so here at Holden, how would you describe the climate?
Cold.
Unseasonably chilly.
Yeah, okay. Unseasonably chilly.
Which day do you have in mind?
Yeah, okay. So variable.
You know, which hour during the day, you know, 5 minute span.
Okay. Yeah. Then I would go on to ask things like, do you make a distinction between the climate and weather? Is there a difference between those two things in your mind?
You ask
yes.
Yeah, yes, of course there is.
Okay, what's your impression of
this? Well, weather is a day by day thing, okay. Phenomenon, and okay. Climate change or climate is a long term pattern.
Okay. That's some people don't realize that. It's really interesting talking to people, and it's not, I mean, we're not judging or anything like that, but it's interesting what level of detail people are going to. When I talked to somebody who's the county meteorologist, he knew, you know, he knows all this information about climate and weather. But when I talked to, say, the public health person, she didn't necessarily make the distinction between the two. And so, again, the question always goes back to, does that matter? So then the interview eventually gets more and more specific, and it goes all the way down to the level of, you know, what risks do you see when you ask them that specifically, and how do the people in your community deal with this, like, and do you believe that's effective? So it's pretty straightforward, you know, anybody can do this, it's pretty straightforward.
And so you're specifically going to the interviewees are targeted,
yeah.
They're not anyone in the community, they're policymakers or...
Yeah, for the first part of it, for my particular study, we targeted very specific people. And people we saw as part of the core network of people who had
who were opinion leaders.
Yeah, and I did kind of a matrix thing where I said, okay, I wanted an equal number of male and females, and I wanted to make sure that I got, you know, at a certain age range. And then I tried to do a range of political viewpoints. It's hard to know. Kind of have to have like a bridge person that you, or what do they call it, gateway person who you talk to, kind of knows the community. And then the cool thing about that interview process was at the end of the interview we said it's called snowball effect or snowball technique, where we said who should we be talking to in this community. And so by the end of this process, after we did two rounds of interviews, we were able to map this network of people and you know, kind of like who was at the center of the network. And then who are kind of the people on the edge, and then, you know, like, so this person, kind of who everybody mentioned as being somebody we should talk to, we were like, this is somebody who has a lot of sway in the community, who we should really be communicating with, and who's really going to know a lot about what's going on, and who will be able to make change. And so I'm trying to think about how you guys might apply this in your work if you're interested in community change and community planning or becoming a part of an advisory group. I know from the different interviews and process in different states, advisory groups were created of kind of these core network of people in the community. And
so can I ask you?
Yeah.
So is the goal of your project to actually maybe you could explain whether the goal is really to engage the community in a dialogue about climate change, or whether it's really to sort of identify workable solutions that are aligned or that are compatible with existing science and research.
Yeah, that's, yeah, the goal is community engagement. And we're using that word engagement now. It's kind of the, rather than education or outreach. And I was talking to a woman who is a pastor, and she's like, that sounds just like what we're doing in our community to try to, you know, connect with people and is engage them. And so, yeah, we're really interested in this community engagement and kind of starting a dialogue where everybody is. And in some places, using the term climate change or global environmental change is not helpful. Like, immediately people will just be like, no, we're done, you know. And so then you think, do you continue using that language or what, you know, at some point you can't go any further.
What are you going to say? You want to talk about the weather?
Well, no, no, right, right, yeah, but then you realize, like, your resources are not being well spent in that situation to, like I was talking about the other night, put out publications or provide materials until some sort of community conflict resolution or something or whatever, you know, they're not open, and so it's just a way of finding out whether or not any people are open. And sometimes it's a matter of people are like, oh, you know, I didn't realize that was really hazard in our community or something that we should be thinking about or something I needed to worry about. Or
it's all about the polar bears.
What is it?
It's all about the polar bears.
Yeah, and that's what a lot of people say. And for some communities, it's, you know, not the most pressing issue. Yeah. So, you know, that's part of the process. And it's non-persuasive in that, like I said, we're not going in and saying, here's what you need to know, here's how you need to plan. This is the way to go with it. This group, there's a group that does all sorts of decision making research, and they do they use this method with health issues like the HPV vaccine and other sorts of things to human health. I mean, this is really a public health method too that's being used, and I think the guys who created it are engineers, so it seems to be like
okay.
How do you determine, just interesting, how do you determine the project? Does the community identify a need ahead of time to which the C-Grant program responds?
Yeah.
Or do you come up with an idea and bring it to the community and test it?
That's a good question. I know it's regionally, I mean, I think it depends on the model, the risk that they're doing. The project that we're doing in North Carolina is a very small community, very small township, and I think that, like, high African American population and very low income, but a really strong community, and their big issue is sea level rise or you know, problems with the ocean. And they're really focused, so their project differs from ours in that they're really focused on mapping and talking about where the water is going to come. And so I think the project is really based on the environmental hazards of the area and then also what the community resources are.
But does that come through your, you know, your risk communication method, or is it something that the community brings to you and say, this is what we want to, we need your help in this? I mean, how does...
I think it usually comes from, like, one key person in the community working with one of the extension folks from the university.
Yep.
So the extension people, and these are just, are you familiar with extension?
Yep.
Yes.
Yeah. So they're just kind of, you know, in the community, in the program, and stuff like that. And it's usually these relationships. It's all built on these relationships, and it's kind of, it's interesting to chart on paper because so much of that networking and that human interaction happens, and we've talked through the week at different institutions like churches or, you know, you play music together, or, you know, something brings you together and you start talking about the problem, and all of a sudden, you know, it can be nurtured to grow into something that actually creates change.
Okay.
So, yeah.
So impulse may actually be an informal interaction between people rather than an agency coming to a community or a community going to the agency.
Yeah. Or it's like in the case the county I worked in, there were a few county commissioners and then a very small group of concerned citizens on the coast who wanted to do something. And they were mostly worried about beach erosion and properties on the coast and, gosh, what are we going to do about this? And so all of a sudden, you know, this energy starts to come together and these people start to come together and create this, I don't know if you would call it a coalition or a network.
Networks throughout the federal
Yeah. So so that's a process. And it comes out of this communication method, and it really, again, is, I know Brad King, the potter, he was really upset with me because he felt like I was being too, I wasn't, I was being too timid, or the organization was being too timid, but when this idea of neutrality is kind of important when you're dealing with a controversial issue.
And you filter out an entire level of controversy when you have, you say you're presenting risks about climate change. If people don't think climate change is a risk, they're probably not going to come to the table.
Yeah, right.
So you filtered out some part of the target population or the population in that manner. Yeah. I mean, that's sensible.
Yeah. And that's what we found in a few, the two of the communities where I actually did the face-to-face interviews was, that was one of the kind of findings that we discovered was that, you know, maybe you can invite those people to join in and include them, but maybe that's not a good way to spend resources in trying to change people who are just in complete denial or don't think it's a priority. But,
what happens when those people are the people at the center of your map?
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Where...
then you realize that other things in the community must happen before the plant community planning is going to happen.
Okay.
Before they're going to... Yeah. And again, if it's a matter of budget, like if you think about money and people and where you're going to spend your resources, you know, it's, like I said, instead of throwing all these resources into creating something and, you know, that's really not going to be touched on for these people or be useful, you know,
yeah.
It's a waste of resources.
But aren't some of those people apt to be involved because they don't want you to spend your money?
Yeah.
And they're sort of, you want to put their foot on the brake and...
Right. Yeah, and in that case, then a different, maybe a different... processes in order. You know, it's like kind of meeting people where they are as far as that goes. And I'm not really our extension guy in that area is really more of the one who on day-to-day, week-to-week, whatever, goes, meets people where they are. You know, we kind of just say, here's what we found, here's what's happening in the community, and then he is more the one who puts that into action.
That's what I keep thinking about. Like this kind of identifies pathways for how decisions get made in a community.
Great.
So if you're doing it non-persuasively, you're identifying what those pathways are, finding out how people
kind
think
of
about
mapping it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
Later, when like the extension or some advocacy group or something like that does actually come in with persuasive communication, whatever form that may take,
and
uses what
they know who they need to persuade.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
But in my mind, something like climate change versus something like the HPV vaccine you mentioned as well, those are entirely two different problems in the sense that the HPV is really easy to identify. Here's your problem. Here's the solution. And in very sort of cut and dry ways.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas climate change,
not at all
cut and dry.
Right.
And no way can you really sort of say, here's the problem. Well, you can. I'll get to that in a second. Here's the problem, here's the solution to climate change in your community. You don't actually have to convince people, however, that climate change is real for them to understand that, you know, there's a drought in Texas, or their beaches are washing away, or that they are feeling the effects of climate change, period. You don't have to convince them that climate change is real for them to convince them that they're still feeling its effects, however you may frame that.
Yeah.
And that is the problem. Your beaches are eroding. You're not going to have enough water to water the lawn.
You have a secondary source.
Right.
Yeah.
And that's the problem, and that's the solution that can be, or whatever the solution may be.
Yeah.
Well,
what were you going to say?
I read a book. I don't remember the title, which is certainly a handicap, and I apologize. But it was about draft resisting.
Mm-hmm.
And what they said is that you don't have to. Here's people that agree, here's people that don't agree, and there's a mass in the middle. Just move the people in the middle a little ways your way. That's all you have to, you don't have to
move
them.
Yeah, that sounds like,
Yeah, it's the people in the middle, and that's an educational process and an awareness. and that's all you need to do.
And I, along with this idea of information, the really cool thing about this process is when you get the interviews, you listen to them and you transcribe them, which is a long, difficult process, and you try to get all like ums and pauses in there, and you know, you've taken notes during the interview, and you do what's called a coding, you code the responses, and you have a few people do it to make sure that you're not being completely, well, you are somewhat subjective because you're using kind of your expertise to be able to look, you know, for certain things. But you start to mark things in what people are seeing, and start to look for patterns and responses, and finding misconceptions was the most interesting thing for me, because a lot of times we go in and we think, okay, here's what we need to teach people about, here's what we need to engage them on, and you realize that maybe they already know that, and really it's something else, some other misconception that you need to target. In the community that I worked in, one of the biggest misconceptions that we ran into, a few of them, and then something that we need to test through a survey, is that there's not enough data, or there's not enough information to really do anything about this. A lot of people are like, well, you know, we do something about it, but we just don't have enough information. And it's kind of true that, like, the information is, we're looking at greater uncertainty in the future, but that's really a misconception. And so to go in and to talk about this problem of where does information come from, does it apply, you know, do we have enough information, would be something that we could target. So another thing that we found in these interviews that would be interesting to test, I think I mentioned this before, was the perception that longtime residents are really against doing anything about climate change. And people assume that, but we really don't know if longtime residents in this community as a whole really have that much power or would not want to do something about climate change. So again, it's just targeting per community. And community can be any scale. We looked at the county level. Another state is looking at the city level. So
one of the things that I have found really interesting in some of the work that I've done, I just recently finished a large evaluation project in the state of Oregon of an education reform initiative that was funded by several philanthropic organizations. And they used a very similar approach where they went into 36 communities in Oregon and did these kind of deep, they called them deep listening sessions, where they really sought to engage a similar targeted, you know, group of influencers or opinion leaders in dialogue about education in the state of Oregon. And their belief was, we just need to bring the information, and that will help communities see what's going on. And to their, you know, well, I mean, it was a huge learning for this collaborative group of foundations. Even in the face of, you know, of plenty of information, opinions weren't really changing, or opinions were really different across. People were coming to many, many different kinds of conclusions about education in the state of Oregon and the information. So one of the things that I just think is an interesting problem in terms of persuasion, or, you know, using alternative approaches to basically change people's hearts and minds, is the role of information, and, you know, that assumption that people are rational beings if they just see the facts, you know, they'll let them come to this place. And so often that's so it's kind of, you know, it's really interesting. Your point, what if you have a key influencer, for example, whose opinion and influence is shaped not by information or data or science, but really by, you know,
whatever it is.
I think, and I'm not blaming technology in general, that's not my point this time anyway, but we've become passive, almost like passive viewers, passive listeners, you know, the freely available, you know, information on the internet allows us to only seek out the information we want. We have, you know, no tools, as it were, for engagement with that information, you know, the information, you know, we kind of absorb it, but that, you know, whereas in the past, I'm contrasting, say, pre-internet, if you wanted information, you had to actively look for it, you know, you had to go out and in that process, sift through, you know, what's worth, what has credibility, what does not, you know, that sort of thing.
So you're talking about like having a filter, being able to filter what's good and what's not good?
A filter has an engagement process, though. So you're actually engaging the material, you know, as a thinking human being, you know, because you are actively seeking out the information, you are asking those questions and looking for answers. Whereas, you know, now the scenario you sort of described is almost as if they just sort of, you know, toss the phone book size, you know, information about education and all the statistics and everything on the table in front of them and say, here you go, here's everything you need to know. And we don't really, in general, have tools for, you know, engaging with information in general, whatever the topic may be. But, you know, it's not enough to actually have it available at your fingertips. We still lack tools to be able to put it to use.
I think we have a deeper problem than that in general, in terms of a kind of presupposition that everyone has now with regard to facts. And by and large, I mean, I just simply assume whatever you're passing off to me as a fact is a lie. and you know, first and foremost, we have the political community thank for that, right? I mean, you know, Sarah from Canada, I don't get all the goodies, but you know, of course it made news. Sarah Palin is a foremost scholar on American history, right?
Yeah.
And when questioned later about, you know, even by, what's his name, Wallace on CNN, or Chris Wallace on Fox News about, you know, didn't you feel, you know, a little sheepish or whatever about her facts? And she said, no, I didn't make it. I mean, these were the facts, and she kept spinning it out. So, and, you know, the thing in Congress back a while ago, you know, 90% of Planned Parenthood's money goes for abortion. And the guy was called, you know, that's not a fact. And all he goes, no, but, you know, you can still say this. So that the whole context, and of course we know that has happened with the
wars, for example.
I forget the exposure, you know, with the whole notion global warming was a United Nations hoax and conspiracy and all that, and they doctored all their facts. So that I think, you know, the basic presupposition when it comes to information, you know, of course, all these experts are going to come in here and they'll give me the information and all that, but they all have their own agenda. They all have their spin. And so, you know, when you come into my community, Kirsten, the first thing I figure out is, you know, okay, this is your shtick, and of course, it's a lie.
So skepticism is alive and well in Canada, is that true?
Oh, yeah, sure. I mean, I think skepticism is alive and well, particularly in terms of North America and the way, you know, way it's communicated in news media. And it fits in with what you've said about the internet, because again, we go to the blogs or the sites of... you know, the folks we think we can trust who are lying to us, which may or may not be true. And of course, basically those that we go to are the ones that support and reinforce our own opinions.
Right.
So it becomes very difficult then.
And to dovetail into that, I think you're exactly right. There's a deep, deep skepticism, which then also feeds a divisiveness,
yes.
an inability to really find connections, which for a process or a project that's focused on engagement is a real challenge. Yeah.
I used to think that was just a Western trait, because I was raised, you know, out here, and that was kind of a Western trait, but I think it has kind of come across the country, per se.
So the direct things that influence people, as far as climate change, if you say, get on the news and say, car exhaust is causing climate change, that would be a direct example. An indirect example would be to take a poll and ask people, where do you think the exhaust is going? What is it doing to the environment to get them involved? Or what would be an example of indirect?
Well, I was thinking to myself about what you were saying, and sometimes skepticism maybe is an okay thing, I guess. And fact, I don't know which, I can't remember which philosopher talked about fact. I mean, you know, in the scientific process, we do our best to, or scientists do their best to create good theories and good information, but things are always changing. There's context, there is spin, there is framing. So I guess what we're trying to do is to maybe move beyond this, let's hit people with facts, and do they take it, do they not take it, and actually talk about a coming together or a process where you're kind of almost constructing what is reality for this community at this time, and what are we going to do with these real problems that are affecting us. And I think that, you know, when we talk about scale, you think about, you know, the national scale. I don't even want to deal with the national scale and the media, and that's, it's so big. I mean, I don't even know how to approach who's choosing what media. I have a friend who is a journalist, and he's writing his articles, and he's got his spin on it. You know, we're really talking about a community level where people are coming together in a very local setting, local scale, to come up with solutions and to decide, kind of, to construct what is the problem that we're facing and what are the resources that we have to plan for it. And is it something that we want to put our resources toward planning for? Like in the case of climate change, I sometimes struggle with that too, with this one particular community, because they have so many other problems, you know, with how much money and effort and time do they spend on this one particular issue. And that's really their process and what they need to decide.
The trouble too with some skepticism is that a lot of these problems we have, but this is on a national scale. If a person gets his way, he gets a $2 billion contract to pursue that way. If somebody else gets the money, but then he's kind of out of work. So they fight for what they say, even though it's supposed to be scientists. Sometimes they say what will help them get big contracts.
Or the grant process.
Well, and we're talking about a global phenomenon.
Right.
So the people in Podunk, South Carolina, even if they want to do this, they don't have the means.
What do you mean as far as using this to plan for the community or trying to change climate change? Or?
Well, I mean, are we just going to sit here and whine about climate change?
No,
but I think fixing.
And I
had the wonderful opportunity to live in Barrow for 5 years.
Barrow, Alaska.
And what?
D.C. Barrow.
Barrow.
Alaska.
Climate change is real. But what's happening up there, how does that affect South Carolina?
Well, and that's what I was going to say. I want to just make the distinction that, and I'm just talking about a very small piece of the puzzle, the work that I do. We're not working on mitigation, which means we're not saying you need to stop driving or whatever. We're talking just about adaptation. We're talking about what's your community going to do to plan for some possible hazards, more flooding.
And that's really the only way for, I mean, especially, you know, small communities, for them to think about it and to grasp it is to say, okay, well, what's affecting us directly, and how do we fix that? You can't, you know, to try to think, you know, on a global scale is not going to do anything for anybody, no matter how powerful you are. You know, it needs to come locally, and then kind of small actions spreading out more.
To make the idea of global climate change even harder to comprehend for a lot of people is that it is a global phenomenon that will have immediate, small-scale, local impacts. That's how we will understand it's at the local level. And so when you're talking about, you know, whatever methods a local community has for planning, for adapting to climate change, it comes through things like land use patterns, you know, growth plans or stopping growth plans, you know, when you actually have reached build out, you know, or
something as simple as having a secondary water source or something like that, where, you know, and I think with this, I know that in our project, all of the communities, I think mine was only on the county level, Washington's working with the fisheries, they're all rural, small communities, and I think with climate change or with other environmental hazards, especially if we're looking at greater uncertainty, for example, of climate change. If one community, only one community is experiencing the problem, you know, there are resources outside. But once many communities at the same time are experiencing difficult challenges, those resources from outside aren't going to be as available, and all of a sudden you have a greater level of strain spread across a bigger area. If you think about the oil spill and then the earthquake and tsunami in Japan, and nuclear, and all of a sudden you have these huge problems, imagining a lot of those happening at the same time all of a sudden is a little bit scary. And so kind of being able to prepare this as a community.
I can give you one example of our area. On the 405 freeway, it goes through my our city, Fountain Valley.
Okay. Yeah.
And it's a bottleneck in Fountain Valley. And there have been a lot of proposals, a lot of discussions about what to do about it. Well, if you make it, if they had five more lanes each way, there'd be no problem. But if you do that, it expands the freeway, takes out houses, takes out businesses, destroys the tax base. No, they don't want to do that. So, I mean, you can double deck it, you know, and all, that costs a lot more money than laying it flat, you know, and that's a real type of global problem.
Yeah, yeah.
Are you always assuming, though, that there's, like, climate change, that it's negative to every community?
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, and they said it isn't necessarily all.
The results so far in southern Minnesota that we've seen these last 20 years is that the winters have gotten warmer, and for the most part, we've had adequate rainfall, sometimes a few extra storms. But if you ask people right now about climate change, they say it's kind of nice.
Yeah. Well,
but if you go one state over,
yeah.
If you go one state over, you know, to North Dakota, it's not the case.
Well, in Iowa, we're getting blizzard too, and we've been missing, so it's been great.
Yeah. So,
but that's the thing. I think the science is good enough now, and forgive me for having to point out that we've known about the phenomenon of climate change, at least in a sort of public consciousness level, for at least 40 years.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
That the science is well enough established that the patterns have established themselves, that the local communities, should anybody be willing to look at it, can tell what the patterns of climate change will be. The warmer, you know, warmer winters in Minnesota, you know, meaning less snowpack, you know, et cetera, et cetera.
Not necessarily less snow, adequate water, but just warmer. It's nice to be warmer.
Well, I think you bring up an interesting point that I'd like to just kind of pull up here is not, you know, yeah, we always talk about doom and gloom and all that, but it, again, it's the frame. Instead of thinking about negative, positive, all that, it's change. How and this is just a more general sense, how is our community going to deal with change and what are the changes that we're facing? And this is just one small, and I think that's the bigger question. I'm only focused on climate change in my work right now, but the bigger question is how we're going to deal with change. And then who are our key people who are willing to jump in, and what resources do we have? And I guess my study and what I'm interested in knowing is how do we bring it all together and actually make it work so that it's people have a quality of life and can go on, communities can have a good life. And
that sounds idealistic. No, and I understand your focus on the local and on adaptation, but we can't resist sort of getting into the bigger problem. And I'm in Minnesota, and we sometimes joke about climate change. Global warming isn't all bad. But I understand that in the big picture, it is, and we should be making some changes. But not only do people resist information or not believe it, but I was thinking of what you said at your students, when they believe the information, their response is, oh, we're doomed. Isn't that what you said? And so people
don't feel like they can do anything about it. And that's another thing that kind of a community process would target is what are some small things that we can do that actually, you know, make us feel like we have a little bit of control.
I have a Shishmer t-shirt on.
And
maybe it's going to take couple dozen more Shishmarefs to convince people that there really is a problem.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, Shishmaref is an island, a barrier island off of Alaska, in the Truckee Sea, which is being eroded away. When I was there 4 years ago, they said it would be gone by this time. It's not quite gone, but it's going.
Mm-hmm.
And so people are losing their home, they're losing their way of life, and drastic, complete change of life for them. And maybe it's going to take more of that.
I'm talking people immigrating. I mean, they talk about climate refugees, and you can get into the whole environmental justice issues.
I think this is a community issue as well as broader issue. Part of the presuppositions that we have, and again, it comes from this notion about the fair and equitable reporting or fair and equitable presentation of facts. That although, let's say, 90% of the world's scientists will say there's climate change and global warming, for somehow, right, in reporting or when you have this community meeting, people think that to say, okay, we need to listen to the one scientist who will say global warming, and the other scientist who will say there is no global warming, to put it at that simplistic a level. And of course, right, the assumption then is, well, you know, you have one pro and you have one contra, and see, it's a 50-50 kind of thing there. Now we got to figure out who's right. When of course, that's a lie. Right? Because 90% of the scientists say global warming and 10% are still skeptical. Or again, to use an example of years gone by, this is precisely what we faced with the whole notion of cigarette smoking. Right? That of course, there were always those, and you can still find some today. Well, you know, it's calming, it releases stress, and it actually is
helpful. Also lose weight.
You lose weight, so you know.
The same thing with seat belts, too.
Are you advocating for a stronger...
Well, I think in kind of a crass way, when the things are out there, and it, you know, 90 to 10 or some of that, you just simply have to say, you know, the other side is simply wrong. And they do not deserve the same kind of exposure and all of this stuff that the others do. Can we ever reach that kind of
point? Not with the two-party political system.
What you described is a problem. It's the way the media deals with science and knowledge in general. It's a failure of education on the media part to know what to do with scientific information.
But when the political parties are controlling the news that's out there, and it's an us or them. So it's like, okay, the conservatives are like, well, okay, they have their information. We need to do this. They can't agree with, you know, Fox News can't agree with MSNBC, no matter how. So there can't be. So unless you can get a political system that isn't so divisive, so isn't so us and them. You're not gonna have a news system that's gonna be fair and equitable. You're always gonna say, because it's a business, you know, and because the Fox News is in it to make money, and so they're gonna say, well, we can't have the same viewpoints that these other news, and it goes both ways. Don't get me wrong, it does go both ways, but
indeed it's political, and when you have a two-party system. It shows itself. But yeah. I mean, right now in Canada, we have four parties. But the working presupposition, the way the media still operates, is, you know, the pro and con positions both have to have equal time, equal billing.
Right.
Okay. The factor is that already is an illusion. In certain issues. In other issues, obviously, there is legitimate disagreement where you need that kind of thing to happen.
And
all
again,
I'm saying is we don't pick, we don't sort that out.
It sets up that us-them dynamic, which, you know, I mean, your point about what do we do with change, you know, change on a lot of different levels, you know, change of climate, change in our social structures, changes in, you know, the disparity between those with many resources and those with very few. All of that is a community issue, not an individual issue. And I think, you know, what you're talking about is searching for some kind of process, searching for some way to help a community shoulder that together. And I think that's a real challenge in an us, them, you know, pro, con kind of environment.
And I know in one of my classes, we advocated for the nice dictator, what do they call it?
The benevolent dictator.
I mean, as far as just like, sometimes somebody needs to go in and say,
you know, you had that slide the other day, we were back to talk about politics and decision making. Yeah. And that slide where I think it was in North Dakota, 31,000 scientists have said, or South Dakota, 31,000 scientists have said that there is no such thing as global warming, and therefore we're going to pass this law, et cetera, et cetera, and which they did. And you say Montana is going to be doing the same thing, or at least it's coming up.
And then the effects aren't.
But the 31,000, who is represented in that? Are those mathematicians?
Yeah. I mean, that's Art Robinson.
Are those scientists like Michael over here in philosophy? Are they, you know, what are they? I mean,
yeah.
Who are these scientists? And how many are on the other side of the issue? That was your point. How many on the other side of the issue? And 99,000 say we have it. So which one do you believe? But if the law says, if they say 31,000, that's the only audience they've got, it's an N.
Yeah.
And it's 100% N as far as they're concerned.
In South Dakota, there's only one audience that matters, you know, as far as the politics goes.
Well, part of the response to change, part of a response to change is a head in the sand approach, right?
Yeah.
And that's all part of a head in the sand approach. You know, it's an easy. If there's something easy, I can. I'm just going to stick my head down and decision done.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
Hi, Kristen.
There's
an old question that is asked many people. It says, what do you think the greatest problem is in the United States? Is it apathy or ignorance? And the answer usually is, I don't know and I don't care. But I want to point out on this climate change thing, there could well be a dual effect here. A lot of people think that the Earth does go through natural cycles over a period of time. We know that.
Okay.
And I know what greenhouse gases are too. But the one thing that really bothered me a lot about the Copenhagen thing, which makes me think that scientists are, you know, kind of a bunch of prostitutes in that respect, is that they didn't talk about the obvious solution to climate change, and that is the world has got to reduce its population to a level which is sustainable.
Yeah.
And we're above this now. But they don't want to talk about that, say.
We're
might offend somebody.
Well, but the implications are rather dark.
Well, I'm not saying
you're exactly right.
Have a strong policy recommendation that the world has a stabilized population. It can't grow forever. And that's totally illogical. And it's got and frankly, as people get more prosperous, which they all want to do, like China, India, and so on, if they're going to increase their effect on the environment, you know, like we have 5% of the world's population and use a fourth of the resources. But
yes.
everybody wants to live like that, though. They don't want to stay the way they are. So what I'm saying is that if the scientists in Copenhagen, with 1,000 scientists there, and I saw not one word mentioned about this possibility. Now why? Well, because they get big contracts, big grants to do all this research on some kind of crack brain schemes. The other solution is, it's, I think it's UN report this recently, said that there's as much global warming effect from all the domesticated animals as there is from all the transportation. That's one thing, because methane's about 20-some times as powerful a greenhouse effect as carbon dioxide. But why don't they all become vegetarians? Why don't they advocate that, like non-smoking?
Yeah.
No, there's no money in for the scientists.
Yeah.
I'm skeptical. You know?
Yeah, and so, we it's ready at the end. We'll take one last comment, and then we can maybe
I'd like to inject a little bit of optimism.
Okay.
I think it's within the lifetime of most of us.
Yeah.
They discovered the ozone hole in the Antarctic and figured out it was the spray in spray cans of chlorofluoro or carbon, whatever. And that has been dealt with, and that is resolving, and that is something that has happened that's positive, that has been cooperated on.
Yeah.
So it can happen.
I think it's Michael Pollan who says, Democrats or Republicans don't make any difference. It's the business, the one to support the research, that control everything. They control the media. They control what we know and what we're not going to know. And so it's not going to be very effective until something is done about that.
I thank you guys so much for all your help. I'm sorry we can't continue this, but at lunch or on the trail in the sun, get topics for conversation. And actually, I thank you so much too for your comments and your brilliance and experience. This helps me think personally about this stuff too quite a bit. So thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.